Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, June 8th. I'm Ray Graff. On this edition of the Vox Pop Gardening Show, we welcome two heavyweights, gardener Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. They're here to answer your questions and help make sure your lawn and garden look good. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, if you have a gardening question. 1-800-348-2551. You can email as well, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Fred and Greg and your gardening calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, and it's always a fun time to do a gardening show, especially on a day where it really feels like summer. And joining us to answer your questions, Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. If you do have a gardening call, I do recommend you call early. We'll blast through a few emails that came in very early this morning, and then we'll hit the phones, and before you know it, the lines will be loaded. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Yeah, we have some space for email, but we won't get to all of them either. But you can try. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number, it's the best way. 800-348-2551. Greg Ward, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. And Ray, I'm sorry I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
But next time, I promise I will.
Well, we've had several high-level meetings about it, and we're going to be extending to you a little leniency here because you've
been so
good to us over the years. Greg Ward, welcome back. Fred Breglia, how are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing, Ray? Good to be back.
And what's your excuse?
You know, I'm in the middle of a global conference right now, the American Public Garden Association, and this week it's a virtual conference, so it's, you know, here at the office and, you know, sitting back and looking at all the gardens around the country, but
cool.
Definitely took time to make sure that the WAMC doesn't wait for nothing. So
that's great. Are you going to loop in a few gardeners to the show? Because if you do, I'll take a break.
I paused them. We're gonna resume after the show.
All right, fair
enough.
You
guys, you get me exclusively.
All right, well, that's good. Well, let's get right to it then. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have had so many emails have come in since this morning. And this is the first one that came in. This is from Steve. Steve's subject heading, two quick drip irrigation questions for today's show. I'm installing by myself a simple drip emitter system. Does a typical mixed perennial bed need the same, more or less water per week than the one-inch conventional wisdom about lawns? That's the first question. Greg.
Yeah, if he's mulching, which I assume he is, then I think 1 inch is more than enough. The trick with a drip system is that the perennials are different. They're different sized plants and even have slightly different requirements. So you might want to, depending on the size of the clump, change the emitter amount, the amount of gallons per hour that come out of the emitters according to what he's laid out in the perennial bed.
All right.
That's it.
All right. Second part of that one, is it better to run drip irrigation, for instance, once a week for 6 hours or alternating days for 2 hours?
You want me to work on that one, too?
Well,
I always think that a significant saturation, a thorough saturation, getting the water, enough water, and a drip system is great because it's very slow to add water, to get it as deep as possible in one shot. To do shorter runs more frequently means that the soil at the bottom may never get really wet. So a heavy rain once a week, I think, is ideal. Or a heavy irrigation once a week.
All right. That one is dispensed with. This one I'll throw Fred's way. This is from Rosemary in Delmar. Rosemary writes, I love poppies, and I've tried numerous times over the years to grow them. I purchased plants from quality nurseries, have planted them in various levels of sunshine in my garden, but they never seem to return the next year. What am I doing wrong? I walk around the community and see the beautiful poppies growing almost wildly in other gardens. Help! And that's from Rosemary in Delmar.
Well, you know, a lot of the poppies that you often see, in a lot of cases, they're actually annuals. And a lot of times people do sort of think they're perennials because they come back all the time. And even at the Arboretum, and there's a lot of different kind of poppies as well, for example. But we have a lot of different ones in the gardens. And sometimes, you know, you won't get them to come back, especially if someone's been in there weeding. Or if you don't let the seed heads go all the way to seed and dry right out and literally fall into the ground. And then sometimes people will mulch them too heavy early spring. Those little babies get pulled out. So you do have to kind of treat them more, I'd like to say, as more of an annual that has perennial qualities. They tend to seed themselves in well, and I tend to think that if she's not getting them to come back, it has something to do with whether or not she's letting the seed heads go to full maturity and literally drop and dispense into the ground before you cut them out or cut them back in the fall. And or they are getting a chance to mature. The seeds do drop, and then in the spring, possibly the new plants are getting either pulled out by gardeners. It's hard to identify those little tiny plants in the springtime, and or mulching could suffocate them. But my guess is probably a combination of those things. And if you watch that, you should definitely get the poppies to come back year after year. Sometimes the seed production is not as good, but generally they do tend to want to come back pretty easily.
It's the gardening show today on Vox Pop. Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery and Fred Breglia from the Landis Arboretum join us. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for these guys, this one is from Shelley in Woodstock, and this came in quite a while back as well. Shelley, and I'll throw this one to you, Greg, because I know you like talking about slugs. I know when it rains, the slugs come out, but this past week I had at least 50 slug babies, big ones, small ones, creeping on my front porch. I know slugs usually go to the garden, but I'm curious why there are so many in one day. I did not see any during the past rains this past week. I use the beer method and also salt. So do I. In the garden, I put Sluggo. Is there another solution when there are so many on a front porch near my front door? It was shocking. The number of slugs that appeared in one day.
Wow. Wow, that is shocking. So, yes, you know, the weather has apparently been good for slugs, and they are starting to show up now. So it is actually a great reminder for everyone to get out there and just either look around, or if you know there are plants that you typically have problems with slugs, to do the treatment. That product she mentioned, Sluggo, is iron phosphate, and it's non-toxic to you or I. It actually adds a little phosphorus to the soil and a little bit of iron at some point, and it's very effective. They eat it, and it doesn't work out for them. So applying that to the areas where they're otherwise, you know, feeding on some plants is definitely recommended. The beer method, you know, is like making little swimming pools with a little plastic Tupperware.
Sure.
And put them in the ground, and you pour some beer in there, and they like the yeasty smell, so they come and you know, drown themselves essentially in the beer. So that's, you know, not a bad way to go, I guess, if you're a slug.
Well.
So, you know, that both of those things work quite well, and to get out there and do it. Now, slugs do hide under porches, so if she's, you know, she's getting them near the house, if there's some place that they can hang out during the day when it's hot and then they come out at night, that's something to consider, and maybe making those areas a little less conducive, either you know, leaving some stone there, a drip edge of stone, or just treating the edges with a little more Sluggo would be recommended.
All right, tremendous. We have a couple of minutes here before our first break, and the lines are loading up at 800-348-2551. We'll dispense with three more emails that came in well before the show began, and then we'll break and then hit the phones in earnest. This one is from Rich in Boston Spa, and I'll throw this one to you, Fred. In late April, I purchased a rhubarb rootstock from a local nursery. The tag on the rootstock didn't have any instructions on planting it, so I followed some directions I found online. I mixed compost into our sandy soil, buried it about 3 inches down in a location that receives light throughout the day. I kept it watered. No growth has appeared. I assume that I should have seen something by now, or am I wrong? Please give me tips on growing rhubarb if I should decide to try it again next year. And that's from Rich in Boston Spa.
You know, I would think that he would certainly have seen something by now. Generally, you know, we sort of plant them in early spring when we do have them. They usually produce for many years. They, you know, tend to have they're usually pretty hardy. So, you know, I don't know exactly if something maybe ate some of those roots underground, possibly. It's a potential. He might have also, I don't know how deep the gentleman planted it. But in general, they definitely do really well. You know, full sun,
he planted
slightly
about,
rich soil.
He planted about 3 inches down, Fred.
About 3 inches down. Yeah, that sounds about right. They don't like, I know they don't like soggy conditions, so if there's any kind of water down there, that's definitely going to be one of the things that'll be, it'll end up causing some root rot. It'll probably end up having some poor growth and or no growth. Mm. And I'm not sure where he got the source from as well. Did he mention that?
No.
No. So that also makes a factor. But it sounds like, you know, if it's not up by now, I think I would tend to try to replant it. And because they're generally really hardy.
Okay.
And I've never had too many problems with rhubarb.
All right.
And usually last for 8 to 10 years before they start to needing a replant, in my experience.
All righty. Two more, and then break, and then phones. This is from Ann and Adams. This is for you, Greg. Two quick questions. First of all, I used some garden soil I had stored over the winter. Nothing is growing in it. It's really strange. Not even spinach is growing. So did something bad happen? Can you store it over the winter and have it grow sterile?
No. The short answer would be no. Something else is happening there for sure. If she's getting poor germination and, you know, the soil wasn't otherwise, it was dry and looked like it did in the fall,
yeah,
I would say there might be a germination issue with the seed is just as likely as anything else.
All right. And then Anne goes on, I took a lot of seeds from my plants that are growing very well. At least they were growing very well last fall. I planted them in the ground, not the bad stored soil, and none of them took. So I guess growing things from seed is a lot harder than I thought. Any advice would be appreciated.
You know, maybe storing the seed, too, how she stored the seed. If she collected it from the garden and you don't collect it right or let it go to complete maturity before you take it. You know, growing things from seed, certain seeds will require certain types of stratification. Some of them require cold periods. It's not hard to grow from seed. It's just they're not – all seeds are not created equal. So they're all requiring a little different care for storage, for getting them to sprout, et cetera.
Okay. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's no, you fine. Go.
Well, just most – if it's vegetable annual seeds that she's collecting – you know, they, as Fred said, they may not have been kept right, but they can just be in the house. They may not have been dry enough when they put them away, and they molded a bit and went bad that way as well.
All right, I'll tell you what, we are way overdue for a break, so we'll do that, and then we'll do the one remaining email here for now. There'll be more emails later if we have time. 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today, Fred Breglia and Greg Ward, and you. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop, Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Last email, then we'll throw this one to Greg and we'll try to make it snappy here. Can you propagate a Harry Lauder walking stick? If so, how would I do that? And that's from Kim. My first question is, what the blue blazes is a Harry Lauder walking stick?
It's a type of filbert, a European filbert that has a contorted stem. So the stem is very curvy and has a lot of S turns in it. And apparently Harry Lauder was maybe a vaudevillian who sort of, that was his shtick, if you will.
Yeah, okay.
He walked around with a kind of a curvy cane. I think that is the story.
I see.
And so they named it after him. It was a found, selection out there in the world, and it is grafted. It's all pretty much always budded onto a seedling of a European filbert. So you would need, ideally, to do it well, you would need a seedling or two of filberts, and you let them grow to, maybe 8 or 10 inches in a little, about the thickness of a pencil, and then you go over to your Harry Lauders and you cut a branch off of it that's about the same thickness, and you join the two together. You top the seedling and you put the Harry Lauders scion on the top, and then you mist it for a while. You put a little wax or a little rubber band around it until it
until they take.
Yeah.
And usually I believe that is done when they're dormant. So you would be doing this in the late fall, winter, but in a cool greenhouse.
Our number here,
a little tricky.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today. Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery in Great Barrington. Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. And George is in Saugerties. George, you're on.
Hey, sorry, I'm on speakerphone.
Hi.
Hi. So, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a lilac bush tree. It's about 40 years old at least, and it's got like four or five main boughs coming off it, I guess, whatever you, main trunks. They're all like 5 or 6 inches. So do I take it down and get a new lilac bush, or can I somehow rejuvenate this thing by pruning it back somehow?
Fred Breglia.
Yeah, so well, you definitely don't need to take it away and get a new one. Lilac is a great shrub because it's actually got an ability to do a couple of things. You can keep it in check by pruning it every year or every other year. But once they kind of get out of control or they get really tall and old and sort of leggy, then they have the ability to be rejuvenated, just as you was asking about. So the timing on this one's a little bit off for you to rejuvenate it this year. The timing, if pruning it is not an option, in other words, can you shorten it? Can you cut back to another lateral branch? Is that going to accomplish it? Do you have much sprouts down below if you remove those really big canes, those really big brows? If you took those away, do you have anything else there, like a bunch of small sprouts, or do you not much? You don't have much else beside the large canes? I guess that would be one question.
No, this is all like, you know, I've got the four or five big sprouts, and then I've got a whole bunch of little ones trying to come up too.
Yeah, so what you're going to end up doing is you're going to end up replacing those big ones over a period of time or all at once, depending, with all of those small ones. So if you wanted to try to remove about 30% of the big ones, you could do that this year after they bloom, which would be probably right around now. You would take them right to the ground. If you have like 8 or 9 of them, I would say probably, if you have 9, I would remove probably no more than 3. You could remove the 3 largest ones, and you could head back some of the other ones and encourage those other sprouts to grow. They're going to take over and become the new shrub. Your other option would be
okay.
Let it go this year, wait till next spring. In the spring, prior to the growth actually coming out, the buds begin to swell. You could literally cut all those big canes or big branches right to the ground. And if you do that with the right timing, you're going to get into a tremendous amount of regrowth. And then it'll be a matter of just thinning out some of those other ones and encouraging a brand new shrub. But it will form a brand new shrub. I mean, I've done some pretty radical things with lilacs over the years and amazed, you know, when you see the result after a couple of years. If you do rejuvenate them next spring, again, your timing will be right when the buds begin to swell. But before they open, before you see the green leaves, cut them all out.
Yeah.
And just know that year you won't probably have any flowers, especially on the new stuff that comes up. But if you have some of those old sprouts that are going, I'd leave them alone, and they may end up flowering for you nicely. And it'll become a big shrub pretty quickly. It'll have so much tremendous power from the root system that you'll probably, you know, wouldn't doubt that if you had a 4-foot-tall shrub in one season.
George, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Gardening Today with Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. Spencer is in New Paltz / Rosendale. Which is it, Spencer?
It depends on how fast I drive, I guess.
All right, go ahead. You're on.
Well, voles. How do I get rid of voles? And I'm not talking about a football team from Tennessee.
You're talking about voles?
How do I get rid of those little voles?
Voles with a V. Greg.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. It's actually pretty tricky. There seem to be a lot of voles coming up. They do like to hide in stone walls or, you know, old piles of compost if you haven't gotten there. So the first thing I like to recommend is making sure that the gardens are well tidied up as you go into fall and winter and as you come around the spring, so that there's no place for them to hang out over the winter. So you just start the spring with less of them. Once, you know, you have them cultivating, again, not allowing for these sort of hinterland areas for them to hide out in it if they're going to make it into your garden, to run from there to your garden. And then lastly, once you, you sort of have them, maybe they're in established planting beds, shrub beds, et cetera, they're pretty easy to find the entry exit holes, and you can either apply a mouse trap with some bait and then next to that hole, and then put a pot, some kind of cover over the trap so you don't, catch a bird by mistake. And that's pretty effective. It means you're going to be setting, half a dozen or so traps out there and checking them on a regular basis. But that can work pretty well. There are also some products out there that are listed as poisonous to voles and come as a pellet of some kind that you could consider putting in those holes. But now you're adding, a poisonous bait to your landscape, so you have to make that decision.
Right. So basically, the key is to find the entrance or exit hole.
Yeah. Exactly.
We've removed all the any debris they could hide in is all gone, deadfall and whatnot. But I have to find an entrance or exit hole. So if I just make my own hole, they're going to avoid that. Like if I make a hole in one of the tunnels, they'll avoid that.
You can make that hole, but most likely you'll be able to see the usually quarter size, maybe half dollar size at the most, a little smaller hole that they run in and out of. And that just gives you a point of delivery for the trap. You can, if you think you can make a hole along their tunnel and that becomes the new entry exit, sure. But using theirs obviously would be preferable.
Spencer, thanks a lot for the call. It's Gardening Today on Vox Pop with Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery. Donna's in Woodstock. Donna, you're on.
Hi. Can you eat voles?
Can you eat voles? That's a great question. Fred, you look like you may have eaten a vole in one time.
I think everything is edible once, they say. I personally wouldn't recommend it. Certainly it's part of a food chain, and animals eat them all the time. So, in that sense, if it was survival, we probably could think of a lot worse things to eat if it came down to survival. But I wouldn't put them on my food, my menu, unless it was really getting
hurt. The question is about rhododendrons.
Oh.
All right. Oh, thank God. That's going to be a little easier, I think, for me. Go ahead.
Maybe voles eat rhododendrons. Can you eat rhododendrons?
Good heavens. What is this, Food Friday?
Everything's edible once. I would not recommend eating rhododendrons, no.
Okay.
All jokes aside.
All right.
Now we've established that.
Anyway, it seems to me that the rhododendrons have bloomed and they're going to be trimmed. And is this a good time to do it so they get blooms next year? And if you want, can you grow them from the cuttings? And if so, how long would it be?
So they just finished blooming, you said, correct?
Yes.
They just finished blooming?
Yep.
Flower? Correct?
Yep.
Yeah. So then your timing for pruning is perfect. You really want to time it right after they get done blooming. You're going to go in there and selectively prune, cutting back to laterals or to nodes. And whether you're trying to make them shorter or more compact or a little less leggy or just a little more aesthetically shaped. But all of those are all good right now. So you just go in there, and I generally don't recommend more than 25 or 30% total volume of foliage to be removed in any one setting. So just limit yourself to about a quarter of the foliage, and you can go in there and prune right now, and that will give you maximum rebloom for next year. The flower buds that will form for next year's flowers are going to start setting those flower buds up literally right after they bloom. So the quicker you get in there, get them off, that gives you more flower power for next year. Now, your other question was...
we were waiting for the butterflies and bees to finish.
I know, they love them. And that's a great plant to bring in a lot of those pollinators and a lot of the butterflies and a lot of the bees. And your other question was in terms of starting more of them, could you do it from cuttings? And yeah, they do. There will be a certain requirement in terms of making the cutting and then getting it under a little bit of mist. You probably will need a little bit of a rooting hormone and a specific media. But if you wanted to do that sort of as a homeowner, you could probably do that in some flats of media, taking some small cuttings about the size of a pencil. And you could try using a little rooting hormone, sticking them in there, and you could either put a little plastic, make a little, like, micro hoop house. But, you know, my dad has actually had an incredible amount of luck years ago starting a lot of woody plants like that, and he never really had to put much of a cover over them. He had the patience, and he did go out there with a spray bottle and mist them, because it will require a misting system. In a, in a production system, they're going to actually have an automated misting system when they do rhododendrons. But they do root fairly easy, and another trick sometimes to get a rhododendron to reproduce would be if you had a lateral branch that was close to the ground, kind of growing along the ground naturally really close on one of your existing plants. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard of layering or that technique for propagation or not, but layering is a technique where you basically take the lowest branch and bury it in the middle, and you bury it with soil that's around, and you kind of keep it buried in just that little spot for maybe a year. And a year later, you go back and check it, and a lot of times you'll have roots there. And when you have the roots, you can make a cutting with a pruner and take the growing part away, and you'd have a new plant. That has worked as well for some. It works for a lot of things.
Wow.
It even
works for
one of those Harry Lauder walking sticks that we had a call on earlier. But that's a hard one to propagate. Rhododendrons are much easier.
Well, Donna, thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. The Garden Show today with Greg Ward and Fred Breglia, and Patty is in Tivoli. Hello, Patty.
Hi, Ray. Love you. Love your show. I have two quick questions. One is about corn. I got a six-pack of corn. I successfully thinned it out to 18 plants. I put them in, there are three rows in a 4x8 raised bed. And the plants themselves in the rows are about 12 inches apart. The rows are about 14 to 18 inches. Should I remove the middle row so the rows are like 2.5 feet apart for a successful yield?
Greg.
I think it looks pretty good. I was just drawing a little scheme of it on my piece of paper here, and I don't think you really need to do that. Crowding them, you know, 14 inches, 12 inches, that's not really that crowded, and keeping them all together does provide for ideal pollination because they're wind-pollinated, so everybody gets some. I would leave it alone.
Okay, cool. All right, and then I have two honeysuckles in resin whiskey barrels, separate plants. I've had them for like 7 years in the plants, and they get decimated by aphids every year. But when they do flower, they're my hummingbird feeder. So last year, I actually found a mantid casing at a friend's garden, plopped it in one of the plants. The mantids came out, and the baby mantids ate all the aphids. So I had hummingbirds galore. The aphids are back, and I'm just wondering if I should bite the bullet, cut the plant down really hard, take it out, change the soil, and then put it back in.
I was just going to say the aphids, I don't think you're going to make a major factor if you change out the soil. They're easily controlled, and you can spray them with an insecticidal type soap. And the key is to get like one of those pump sprayers so that you can get under the undersides of all the leaves where all those little aphids hide. And and that generally could take care of them. They also do sell beneficials that you can release right onto the aphids, like ladybugs are incredible decimators of aphids. And it's also quite neat to see them feed.
Away. Like people say it lasts for 24 hours and then the ladybugs fly away. But you say go for it and reduce the population even if the ladybugs fly away.
Well, if you've got aphids on that plant and you put the ladybugs there, they're not going to leave a bunch of aphids uneaten. So, you know, that's certainly going to be one way to go. And then maybe if they did leave, at least they're going to go to maybe hopefully another part of the garden. And, you know, another thing with ladybugs, and I'll throw this out there just because I do it myself, if you happen to have one of these houses where they come in the fall and the winter by large numbers, especially the old houses, you can actually collect those, and as long as your significant other is okay with it, you can keep them in the fridge, and you use a paper towel to keep them moist, and you'll actually be able to keep them through the winter. They'll go into a state of dormancy. They won't move, but in the springtime, you just basically put them outside, and, you know, I've released, I can't even, countless numbers of ladybugs.
Right.
Very few don't make it. As long as you remember to put in wet paper towels when they dry out in the refrigerator. You keep them sort of in with the vegetables.
Again, you got to have a wife at home that says that's okay.
All right,
or a husband.
I got to tell you something, Fred. I am not surprised that you put ladybugs in the fridge over the winter. Greg, did you want to say something?
I did. That well, I was surprised too, because there's limited room in the fridge, and so
yeah.
No, I'm teasing. But I did want to say that with the honeysuckle vines, usually what happens with aphids is the plant grows out, it blooms once the aphids move in, at that bloom, and then it's kind of unsightly. And pruning them back at that point, or even now, if the aphids are really heavy, pruning the plants back does allow you to have sort of a serious reduction in the aphids, and the plants will usually grow profusely and have that nice second bloom with a lot less aphids. Or if you're going to do that treatment of treating them with a little insecticidal soap or something, cutting them back first anyway, so that you're only treating a limited amount of the plant and then having it grow back is really preferred.
We'll take a quick break here. Greg Ward and Fred Breglia join us. It's Gardening Today, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Fox Pop, Ray Graff with you. It's Gardening Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Fred Breglia and Greg Ward join us to answer your questions. And Greg Stanley writes, please advise when mulch should be used for flowers and plants and how much to use.
So, any material that is a mulch material is great, because it, by covering the soil, you create that interface where there's a lot of activity, both root activities, microbes are breaking down the soil. The soil doesn't harden up. So I think using some kind of mulch everywhere that you have a soil garden is highly recommended. Then it becomes, which mulch do you use for which plants, both aesthetically and what's going to be maybe a little more appropriate. So some of the finer mulches for annuals and maybe some of the mulches that will break down more readily for your herbaceous perennial garden, because you're going to be working in that garden, and things like straw or salt hay or something similar for the vegetable garden, because you're probably picking all that up or turning it in, putting it in the compost at the end of the year. So I would recommend mulch every time.
This one is from Elizabeth in Troy, and Fred, will throw it your way. This says, the fabulous pawpaw, but how good is it that you have this program? Well, we'll find out. Ellen writes, I was so excited to grow pawpaw from 5 seeds. They all grew to 12 to 22 inches, but I read that adults put out a miserable amount of suckers. Can they be stopped? That's question one.
All right. Well, pawpaw is an incredibly awesome native plant, so I definitely like pawpaws a lot. We have them here at the Arboretum. They produce an incredibly cool flower, a very unusual flower, and they also have an edible, in this case something that we can eat, fruit. And the fruit actually resembles sort of the flavor of a banana, I guess, and sort of what I've heard other people describe it as, and what I also have thought about it when I've ingested it. That being said, they do produce suckers sometimes, but I've never seen the suckers be an issue. We have a lot of plants that produce a lot of suckers. Crab apples are just one of the most famous probably landscape plants, and used or probably overly used in a lot of cases, but they always produce tons of suckers in the sucker management. You go out there, you clip them all off. To me, the pawpaws are not really a plant that has a sucker problem. I tend to let some of those suckers actually go, and they do form sort of a, what we call sort of a clonal clump as time goes on. But usually, if you don't want the suckers on there and you want it to be more of a specimen plant, it's not hard at all. Just go in there, just kind of be diligent, clip them off, and then all that main energy will go to the parent plant, and you should be in pretty good shape in that case. I've never had an issue where we had too many suckers on there. We really can't handle it. But I have had that with other plants like apples, cherries, plums, even lindens can produce an incredible amount. To me, the ones that you get on the pawpaws, not as big of an issue.
All right, second part of Elizabeth's question. If not, yeah. The pawpaw, I won't buy another pawpaw for pollinating. My yard is 28 feet by 27 feet. with 10 various trees. I love trees. What's a good one to grow in a very large pot? And that's from, again, Elizabeth.
She wants to grow this in a container, she's saying?
I believe a tree, I think she's talking about.
Yes. Tree in a container. I mean, if you're going to be growing a tree in a container, you're going to have to figure out what to do with that tree in the wintertime, because the trees around here are going to want to go dormant. So if you wanted to grow an ornamental, you know, to me, I would encourage the person to put it in the ground or figure out a way that you're going to be able to move that. Because if you just leave the plant, the container out above ground, when we get one of those really cold winters, I'm afraid she'll lose it.
Okay.
Otherwise, you can grow almost anything in a container. If I was going to do something in a container, I think I would tend to go more tropical because you're going to bring it in anyways. But if you wanted something hardy, I would more advocate to plant it directly into the ground in this case.
All right.
I got a couple of hardy choices. I'm not saying that they wouldn't potentially die, as Fred said, but crab apple, so a dwarf crab apple like a Sargent's, or tree form panicle hydrangeas, both in a neat, reasonably large container can survive the winters for a while. For a while is the qualifier there.
It's Vox Pop. It's Gardening Today with Greg Ward on Fred Breglia. We go back to the phones, and Cheryl's in Lake George. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I had questions about growing tomatoes. I know that watering is an important factor in how you water, and what I understood is you shouldn't water the plant itself. You should water below, like on the dirt. So that is something I've been trying to do. But the other thing is, how often should I water them? I want to avoid them developing roots that are, you know, close to the top. And then the other question is, if tomatoes get a disease, like how brutal can I be with taking off the leaves?
Greg Ward.
Yeah, so, we were talking about mulch earlier, and whether you have a tomato in a container or in the ground, adding some kind of mulching material, again, often straw is not a bad idea, something like that, will hold moisture to allow you to not have to water as frequently. As you said, watering, especially these are, right now, everybody's plants are young and little, and really saturating the ground around them once every, with the weather we were just having, every, two or three days maybe, but now we're going to be getting into some cooler weather, so maybe twice a week would be plenty. The diseases that tomatoes typically get, late blight is when the lower leaves tend to get sort of yellow spottiness and sort of start to fail or fade, but the top is still green. And so good watering, a mulching material that minimizes splash from the ground up onto the plant. And yeah, as those leaves discolor, you can pinch them off. There's nothing wrong with that. If your plant is healthy, the soil is good, the fertility is high, the plant should grow, like a rocket for the next 6 weeks. And most of that discoloration really shouldn't start occurring, as long as they're not stressed, shouldn't start occurring until August sometime. And by then you have lots of fruit, we hope.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate you hanging in there. And now we go to Katie in Boston Spa. Katie, you're on.
Hi. I have a peach tree that for the first year is totally, totally loaded with peaches. And I understand that I have to remove some of them to have good fruit. Is that true?
Fred.
Sometimes thinning them out if you're overloaded is an idea that people do. Most of the time, the plant will actually thin itself out. So most of the time, if it's really loaded and a tree can't handle it, it'll tend to drop a number of them and be able to keep the ones that it can kind of handle. It almost self-culls in that way, if that makes sense. If you really have so many on there and they're pulling down branches, you could go out and try to selectively take one off here, one off there. But I don't really think that would be too necessary. I think, as long as, the plant's healthy, the tree will do what it needs to do. It'll call out the ones it can't handle. It'll grow the ones that it can. Make sure you're giving it water to break up drought times from here, occasionally.
It'll help it get through the hot, dry summer, especially the really dry times. And otherwise, you know, you should be in good shape. A little mulch, though, would be good, like we talked about on the other questions, some organic mulch, preferably like a bark mulch, not up on the stems, but out around the drip line. That'll help create a bit more structure with the soil. It'll actually help create a better root system for the plant, and it therefore may end up being able to hold more peaches. So you could, you know, selectively give it a little fertilizer, a balanced organic fertilizer, generally in the spring or in the fall, two top times. But you could put down a light fertilization even right around now, and that tree will take it in. And again, between the water, the mulch, and the fertilizer, I tend to think you'd be all right. You know, a little bit of pruning, dead wood, crossing branches, suckers, we talked about those. They should be removed, but otherwise you should be in pretty good shape.
Katie, thank you very much for the call. And now to East Greenbush. Mandy, you're on.
Hi. Hopefully two quick questions. One kind of follows on a question you had earlier about pruning rhododendrons. I have a whole wall of, in my backyard, of huge rhododendrons and even a huge azalea that's like over 10 feet tall and about 15, 20 feet wide. They really need some serious pruning. They're really, a lot of them are really leggy. And so you're saying like 25 to 30%. So would I just plan on having to prune these over a series of years to try to?
Yes, that would be their goal. You could, as we talked about one other caller earlier about the lilacs, and if it really gets so leggy, it just doesn't look like you have that much to cut back to, then there's a potential rejuvenation that could occur, and that would be in the springtime before the growth occurs. You could cut those longer, leggier ones right to the ground. But if you've got a lot of foliage there and they're leggy, then I would not do the rejuvenation. I would just start to head back 30%, and it does take sometimes maybe 2 or 3 years to get them to the size you want. That's exactly the sort of the methodology that we're talking about.
Greg, you want to chime in
and
there?
To make them, you know, to make them sort of continue to kind of look nice, taking that major largest leader, reaching down, in this case if it's taller than you, but otherwise in, and taking it off at an intersection, but maybe leaving a couple of the shorter ones. So you're not going to top this thing. You know, you're not going to take the whole top off. You're going to leave some of the shorter, you know, leaders that are reaching all the way to the top of the tree. Take some of the bigger, heavier ones out. Those bigger, heavier ones will, as Fred was saying, they'll start to branch out this year. They'll put out new buds later this month, 1st of July, and start to fill in. And then next year, you can start to work on some of those shorter ones. So you're doing it over the course of a couple seasons, and you're not just sort of, you know, taking the head right off of it.
All right, back to the phones. John and Hadley. John, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about apple trees and blueberry bushes. How far should you plant an apple tree away from your blueberry patch, given that the blueberries need an acidic soil?
Greg?
Me?
Yeah, that's you,
oh,
right?
I know. Sometimes it's a little fading.
Ray, hello, Greg. It's all yours.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Exactly. So, in terms of, you know, first of all, you want to do a soil test, number one. Number two, apples don't mind. They're in the rose family. They don't mind a reasonably acidic soil. Blueberries would like it maybe a little more acidic, but if the pH is in the 6 range or high 5s, I believe both will tolerate that just fine. So that's the first thing, do a soil test. And then second, if, you know, an apple tree is going to grow, even a dwarf one's going to grow 12 feet across, at least if you prune it hard, even, you know, 8 or 10 feet across, and your blueberry is going to grow, you know, 6 by 6. So you want to have that spacing so that they're not competing for sunlight or moisture. So certainly, you know, 20 feet on center is kind of a nice minimum if you have an apple tree and a blueberry, something like that. And then, you know, lastly, once you do that at that 20-foot level, you can treat, if necessary, the soil around the blueberry or the apple. But I think it will be around the blueberry if you need to bring the pH down a little more.
John, thank you very much. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left here. Carol's in Ballston Spa. Carol, you're on.
Hello. My question is about chipmunks. I have many chipmunks making many holes in my garden.
Yeah.
And the hole, if I'm looking at the hole, I know it's a chipmunk hole. I've seen a chipmunk go in and out. I can stick a stick down there, and it keeps going. There's no soil around. Like, it seems like soil should be outside of the hole. Where is all the soil?
This is a great question.
I got an answer.
Go ahead.
It's not a good answer, but
good.
Remember the Steve McQueen World War II movie where
the Great Escape.
Yeah. Yeah, The Great Escape. Thank you. That's how they did it. That's how the chipmunks do it, too.
Hey, very interesting.
I don't know what Steve McQueen did.
Well, Greg, it's all yours now. You have 1 minute. Go ahead.
So, Steve McQueen, they sort of put them in little bags and they spread it out somewhere else evenly so that you never really knew. Now, are chipmunks doing that? I have no idea, but obviously they're not. They don't do it all at once, so that like a woodchuck, and make a huge pile.
Right.
And so they have done something with it, and probably, you know, they probably just put it in their cheeks and spread it out somewhere. Is that the question, or are you trying to work?
I don't know. We're almost done with the show. We've sure killed some time.
That sounds okay. So they're very. They're taking it out. They're chipmunking it out in their cheeks. Okay. Thank you, because this is a mystery that I needed solving.
Now, hang on, Carol. Hang on. Now, Greg, are you just making this up, or is this just a thing?
All right, so I will qualify it. They're moving it in some way.
Okay.
I don't know how they're moving it. I think putting it in their cheeks is a possibility.
Right.
Oh, you were kidding.
Oh, yeah. Ha ha.
If you wanted to get rid of those guys, though, you could use a repellent if that's what was going on. I've used and had fairly good luck. It doesn't work so well with the voles and the moles, but it does work fairly well with chipmunks. I've wanted to deter from gardens. And a combination of garlic, hot peppers, pureed up, and sprinkled around, sprayed on your plants that you're, or even in the areas that you want to deter them from.
Yeah.
If you reapply that, okay. I'm thinking you're going to encourage them to move away in a friendly way. So if you're trying to get them out of there, garlic, hot pepper.
Okay.
I have had fairly decent luck. You will have to reapply it. It doesn't last past the first rain. It probably doesn't last more than a week.
But
a little persistence in there, I think you might encourage those chipmunks to move to a better location.
Speaking of moving away in a friendly way, the show's over, gentlemen. Fred Breglia, thank you very much. Go back to your worldwide conference now.
And all right. Well, be well, my friends. Talk soon.
We'll talk to you soon. Greg, thanks for being here, buddy. We'll talk to you in person next time, all right?
Next time. Yep. Thanks.
See ya. Support comes from Chester Common Table, Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts. Locally sourced comfort food, wine, and cocktails, offering socially distant dining indoors and out Thursday through Sunday from 4 to 9 p.m. ChesterCommonTable.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland of the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, supporting the community with a temporary closure and continuing to explore art and ideas online. For projects and resources, skidmore.edu/tang. And Public Sale Auction, Hudson, New York, announcing Vintage T-Shirt Auction this Saturday starting at noon. Preview in person today through Saturday, public-sale.com for details. Thanks again to Fred and Greg for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to everybody for everything in the world. Tomorrow it's real estate.